Welcome to the Michael Rivera What Really Happened radio show.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Saturday, end of the week. We're going to do a little bit of a wrap-up here and just look back over all the craziness. And boy, what a wild week it was. First of all, for all you global warming people, it is cold and wet and windy here in Hawaii. And I realize cold in Hawaii isn't the same as cold in Minnesota. Cold in Minnesota is get out the snow shovel. Cold in Hawaii is the girls are back to their one-piece bathing suits. But it is. It's noticeably cold, which is okay because last night the wife was snuggling up real close to me, which I happen to like that kind of thing. Anyway, before we get into the rest of the week wrap-up, I want to respond to a story that you heard on this last news break. It's all over the place about this college student, parent bodybuilder, very healthy, who committed suicide while broadcasting a webcam broadcast of the whole thing. And everybody's going on about, you know, all those people who were just watching over the internet and why they didn't do anything to help and, ooh, those bad old blogging web people and the whole thing. And first of all, apparently some people out there thought it was a hoax. And a lot of other people did try and talk him out of it, and ultimately, because he took pills and people thought maybe he wasn't really going to die anyway, but somebody did ultimately call the police on the whole thing. But the real issue is, this is putting the blame onto the bloggers in order for the family not have to deal with the fact that they missed all the signs that this kid was in trouble. So I'm sorry, you know, playing voyeurs to a suicide is kind of a little out there, and it's not something I would want to do with a Saturday afternoon. But I think they're trying to bash the internet and the bloggers to evade the responsibility that this kid's family, who were there with him, not logged in over the net, but with him, they missed the signs that this kid was in trouble. They are the ones who blew it when it comes to talking about intervening and helping this kid. So I'm sorry. I think the media is just, you know, grabbing this opportunity to bash the internet because the blogs and the alternative media have become such a serious competition to them over the last, 14, 15 years now, I guess. And so they're going to bash the internet and make it look like, you know, the blogs and the bloggers are the bad guys in this suicide, that somehow we enabled this guy to do it. You know, people were killing themselves before the internet came along. You know, this is just a way to, share the experience, if you will. But ultimately, the responsibility for failing to detect that this guy was in trouble emotionally and that he was suicide rests with the people who were actually sharing space with him, his college friends, his family. They've blown it. They're the ones who blew it, and they want to put the blame off on the bloggers, and I'm not going to let it happen. Now, getting back to the regular sorts of news that we cover here on What Really Happened, and by the way, if you would like to join us on the air, the number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We got 2 hours and lots of phone lines open, so call in and we can have some fun. Now, this last week, the Dow Industrials, the stock market, was all over the place. I think there was kind of an ongoing battle between the plunge protection team wanting things to go back up and the hedge funds, which are very quietly trying to get out of their stock positions slowly and gently so they don't trigger a panic, but they're trying to get out. So there's this back and forth. And the result was we had a huge, huge amount of volatility. For a good part of the week, the Dow was below 8,000. It was right in the middle of the 7,000s. And I think that was kind of a psychological barrier for a lot of people because the conventional wisdom was that 8,000 was the bottom. And a lot of people were staying in the market figuring that, okay, 8,000, this is as bad as it's going to get. We just be patient. It'll start back up again. And then it went right down to the middle of the 7,000s. People were talking 6,000 by Christmas, and people started getting really nervous. Yesterday, the market was all over the place. And then, right before, about an hour before the closing bell, this huge set of put options came flowing in and just drove the Dow right back up above 8,000. It ended 494 up for the entire day. Now, we are being told by the financial powers that be that the reason for the sudden optimism at the end of the trading day was because Timothy Geithner has been tapped as Secretary of Treasury. Now, again, this may just be a convenient cover story for game playing by the plunge protection team, and the reason is it doesn't matter who gets picked as Secretary of Treasury. It's always going to be an insider. It's not like anybody on Wall Street expected something radical to be done. I mean, looking at Barack Obama's staff and administration and cabinet picks to this point, it's all pretty conventional. A lot of it coming out of the Clinton administration. This isn't even Clinton light anymore. It's just shaping up to be a revival of the Clinton administrative team. And, boy, I got to tell you, if I were the deputy White House counsel in this new administration, I would be very, very nervous right now. But the bottom line is I don't think the selection of any particular Secretary of Treasury is responsible for creating an instant bull market amid all the bearishness, because it didn't automatically make our factories more productive. It didn't magically create customers and clients for our products and services. I think the announcement came out and they said, okay, this is put the put options, shove it up there, make everything look good for the end of the week so that people aren't already predisposed to a panic going into next week. So I think that was what was going on there. Now, as for Geithner himself, he is a former president of the New York Federal Reserve. So this guy is coming right out of the belly of the beast. In other words, more debt is good for the Federal Reserve because it allows them to print up more money. That's the way the monetary system works in this country. A lot of us grow up thinking about, oh, money is an item of value that we barter back and forth. And we all saw those little training films that we had in the state-sponsored schools about how, you know, primitive people would use shells and pretty rocks and trade back and forth as a unit of value, and how in our modern civilized society we have these little paper notes, which are actually instruments of debt. And the reason our country is in such dire economic straits is that we have a monetary system that isn't based on units of value. It is based on units of debt. When you sign a note promising to repay a loan, the bank literally is creating the money they loan you out of thin air. The unit of value is your promise to repay. That's the unit of value. The paper note that you're spending, that's the debt obligation. It's actually the inverse of what you might think is going on. So having a former president of the Federal Reserve as the Secretary of Treasury means that we're going to be seeing basically continuation of the Federal Reserve policies to date. And that, I don't think, bodes well for the U.S. in the long term. So if I had had money in the stock market, I don't think I would have gotten all that hot and bothered about the appointment of Secretary of Treasury. But, of course, I've gotten my money out of the stock market, and I've invested it in canned foods and shotguns. Now, Citigroup. We've been watching Citigroup for a while, and if you will remember, some months back, Citi announced that they were limiting the amount of cash withdrawals at their ATM machines. And they came up with this story that they were doing it because hackers had gotten into their automated teller machine system, and in order to protect themselves and the public, they were limiting withdrawals from teller machines. And at the time, the story didn't pass the smell test because the ATM limits were basically everywhere that Citibank was. It wasn't confined to an area where criminals might be operating to loot the ATM machines. And more to the point, no other bank at that time reported any such hacker break-in or was imposing any such cash withdrawal limit. And at the time I said, I think this is the first indicator that Citibank is in serious, serious trouble. Since then, of course, we know that Citibank is one of the major victims of the credit default swap problem. They're in serious trouble. Their stock was almost in free fall for a while there yesterday. And now we're getting word that Citigroup has gone back to the U.S. government and is basically saying that if you do not give us another bailout, we are going to collapse. And on that unhappy note, we're going to take a break here for some commercials. Join us on the air, 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Fear and hate will rule them. said the day went to Hebron. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're talking about Citigroup and Citibank. And apparently these last couple of days, the bank is again meeting with officials from the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury Department. They're exploring options to prevent the collapse of Citibank, which includes another endorsement from the government and a capital injection from the Treasury, which they've already gotten some. Now they're getting more. And, you know, this bailout thing, it's like a run on the American public wallet. It's the looting of the nation. And I have to scratch my head on this one because Citigroup has this deal with the Mets, the athletic team. And the Mets' new stadium is named Citi Field. And Citigroup has this $400 million contract where they pay the Mets in order to have their name on the stadium. And apparently this deal is going to continue when the Mets play their first game of 2009 against the San Diego Padres. The stadium will still have the city name on it. And this contract apparently is something like $20 million a year. Now, I don't know if there's a buyout or an escape clause or whatever, but apparently Citigroup is taking the position, and this is a direct quote, "We remain committed to our relationship to the Mets. It is important to us." Steve Silberman, a spokesman for Citi, said in a telephone interview on Friday. Okay, what this basically means is Citigroup is taking some of this money they're getting from the U.S. taxpayers, and they're using it to put their name on a sports venue for advertising. This at the same time, they're laying off people left and right. So for all of you former Citigroup employees who are now on the unemployment line, struggling to figure out how you're going to keep your home for the next couple of months, I hope you will take solace in the fact that the name of your former employer still adorns a sports arena. And I guess the reason I'm irked is if U.S. taxpayer money is ultimately the source of the funding for this naming deal, I think the stadium should be named America Field. Or maybe Loot the Taxpayer Field, or something a little bit more appropriate than using taxpayer money to put a corporation's name on a stadium, which, as I understand it, was built with public money to begin with. So it's just a whole, I'm sorry, it's a screwed up deal, and I'm sorry, it really is. I'm not at all happy with that. And I'm not even a big sports fan, and I'm not happy with that. Now, the problem with all of these bailouts, let's get down to some fundamentals here. The problem with the bailouts, and even with Bush's old incentive plan and the new incentive plan that Barack Obama is talking about, it's taking the money that's already in the system and just shuffling it around from one group to another. And ultimately, that is all government can do, is take money from one person and group and give it to another person and group. That's all they can do. Government can't create wealth. They don't manufacture anything. They don't have anything to sell. Government is a parasite. It lives off of the work of the American people and derives its entire ability to affect any kind of change from its ability to take money from you and give it to somebody else, like Citigroup, so they can keep their name on the stadium. So stimulus is a wonderful little word, okay, but it's not really bringing any new money into the system. It's just shuffling it around again for a photo opportunity. It's not making the nation any wealthier, or more to the point, it's not really getting the nation out of trouble. If anything, with all the added overhead of moving the money around, it's increasing our total indebtedness. So all these little fix-it-overnight strategies sound wonderful on the radio shows and TV commercials and the news bites, but you don't reverse 8 years of loot the people for the rich policy overnight, nor do you revive manufacturing that's been neglected for 30 years in just a couple of months. And I am very alarmed that Barack Obama, for all his talk about change, is basically coming out with the same, you know, we're going to say anything that sounds like we're fixing the problem tomorrow to placate the voters. And I have to be very honest, I'm not seeing a lot of change. I'm seeing a lot of business and politics as usual coming out of Barack Obama's camp. Not that as I was expecting tremendous amounts from him. I really wanted Ron Paul in office. And I think Barack Obama was the lesser of two evils between Obama and McCain. But, you know, the lesser of two evils is still evil, and that's what Barack Obama is proving to us right now. All right, let's step away from the U.S. and start looking at the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is heating up. The reality is the United States is fading as the what we were told was the world's remaining global superpower. It's creating a vacuum in a number of places in the world, and opportunistic nations, in particular Russia, they're leaping into that void, which is perfectly understandable and to be expected, given the mismanagement of the United States over the last several years. Now, the European Union is taking note of the fact that Russia and some other countries, including the United States, are showing a tremendous amount of interest in North Pole oil resources, Arctic oil. The general cover story is that, you know, global warming has melted the Arctic ice cap, making extraction of the oil underneath the North Pole easier. Actually, that's really a drastic oversimplification. It is the running out of oil elsewhere on the planet that is making the extraction of the oil under the North Pole economically attractive. The reality is that the abyssal plain under the North Pole is so deep that it's all going to be suboceanic drilling, pipelines, and so forth. And drilling through the ice cap, if one is there, is trivial compared to the other engineering problems. In any event, we know that the ice cap is expanding, so we're going to have to drill through the ice anyway to get there. But the bottom line is that Russia has already gone down and planted flags on the North Pole on the seafloor, and we're seeing other countries get in there and say, well, this part of the Arctic ice, our Arctic Ocean floor belongs to us, and the other people are sneering at them and saying, no, historically, this part of the Arctic seafloor has belonged to our country. And so we're shaping up, we're going to have a fight over the North Pole. And all I can say is that, you know, Santa Claus better watch his rear end, because if he shows up on the wrong radar screen, end of December, he may find a missile on his tail chasing him all over the globe. And so that would just be generally unpleasant, I think, for everybody. But in all seriousness, you know, people are talking about a push for a new world war. Can you imagine we're going to be fighting over penguins and polar bears? Penguins are in the Antarctic. We're going to be fighting over polar bears and walruses. And it's just going to be silly. Now, Russian President Medvedev is paying visits to... Oh, end of the segment. All right, hang on to that thought. Medvedev in South America and Cuba. We're going to take a break here. 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. I know you're out there listening. I can see the numbers on the server. So pick up a phone and call in. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
You're listening to the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're talking about Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, and in general, the Russian policy of simply going into all those countries that the United States has pissed off and making friends with them. Now, Medvedev is visiting Venezuela to establish trade relations with them, and Cuba to establish trade with them. And war hawks within the United States are screaming it is a revival of the Cold War Russian-Cuba alliance that was such a danger when we had the missiles of October, blah, 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 blah. Okay, nonsense. I'm calling bull biscuits on this one. The reality is that the United States has created its own international political crisis by adopting a perpetually belligerent approach to other countries. Back when the Soviet Union collapsed, the smart people, I was one of them, were saying now is the time to normalize relations with Cuba, to reestablish trade. They have agricultural produce we need. They make good rum, good cigars. It's a good vacation destination. Let's go back and sort of take things back to how it had been, not necessarily all the way to Batista with the casinos and organized crime and the donkey shows, but let's do business with them. Let's sell them our products. Let's buy their products. That's what the way of peace is. And instead, the CIA hardliners who know how to carry a grudge and the descendants of the Batista government that was kicked out by Castro, who are now living in South Florida, were screaming to keep the Cold War embargo in place and starve little tiny Cuba and portray that Cuba was somehow still a threat to the United States. And so after all that, of course Cuba is going to be open to relations with Russia again. Why wouldn't they? Are they going to just sit there and go on starving in the obviously vain hope that someday the United States might grow up? And the same thing with Venezuela. Venezuela is going to do business with Russia. Russia will get Venezuela's oil, not that they need it. But they'll be trading partners with Russia. Why? Because instead of making friends with Hugo Chavez, the United States keeps trying to kick him out so that they can impose a puppet regime, as seems to be our perpetual hobby in whatever country we go into. We have been playing, the United States has been playing this game. Go into a country, kick out the democratically elected government, put in a puppet friendly to U.S. corporate interests that crushes the people down to make the rich richer, and then we wonder why the entire world hates us. And because in this day and age of the internet and global communications and alternative media, these games don't work anymore, and our government doesn't realize it. And that's why we're on the wane. The U.S. government is unable to evolve to adapt to the changing environment around it. The new technology that makes global communication among ordinary citizens possible on a massive scale. That's the new reality. That's the new environment. And our government is refusing or unable to evolve to meet that new reality, which is why ultimately I think the U.S. government is going to collapse and go the way of the USSR, because it refuses to adapt to the new reality. You cannot lie your way through politics. You cannot lie to your population as domestic policy. You cannot suborn and destroy other countries and put in puppet regimes as foreign policy. It doesn't work anymore because everybody knows that's what you're doing. We're going to go to the phones. We've got Thomas in Sweden. Aloha, Thomas. What's on your mind today?
Aloha. Good morning, Mr. Rivero and listeners. Well, first of all, thank you for mentioning the postcard last week. I was very busy at a party. I'll tell you about that another time. Everything you've taken up here today, I've been thinking about here while swabbing my dicks. Global warming, we don't have that here in Little Darby today. We have 2 days of snow, and I think it's like as cold as it was back in 1800, froze to death. And you mentioned Citibank. Yesterday, I got an offer, or maybe a plea, from Citibank in London to put some money in their bank. And you mentioned this business of the Arctic, maybe the next confrontation point?
Yes.
Can I tell you a story a Canadian told me? This is supposed to be true. When they were up there building the dew line, an Inuit guy came along with his dog sled and says, "No, what are you building?" And he says, "Oh, this is the dew line." And they explained the Cold War to him. And he says, "Gee, I didn't know there was a war on. We're so busy up here just trying to survive, we don't have time to kill each other."
That is a wonderful, wonderful story. And, you know, absolutely true. And for those people in the audience who are too young to understand what DEW line means, DEW stood for Distant Early Warning. It was this line of incredibly powerful radar stations that were built all along the northern part of Canada to watch for nuclear missiles flying over from the Soviet Union. And it wasn't that there was really a danger that was ever going to happen. It's just that both the U.S. government and the Soviet government, you know, swindled their population out of billions and trillions of dollars in rubles by claiming there's an enemy out there that must be defended against. And with the collapse of the USSR, of course, that game went away. Now, as we've seen in recent months, the military-industrial complex is trying to create a whole new Cold War. And so when Russia comes over and starts to talk to Cuba about establishing trade, what do we get in the American press? Oh, it's a revival of the Cold War. We have to start building bombers and bombs and submarines and everything again. You know, money, 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 money. And I think especially young people, and I'm so overjoyed that young people got involved in this last election. Young people need to go back and they need to find a video of Dwight D. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's farewell address where he sits and he just warns us that if we are not careful, the military contractors and their pet Congress critters will take over the country and bleed the American people dry for every single penny to be prepared to defend us against an enemy who really isn't a threat to us at all. I mean, look at what happened in Iraq with Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. We know for a fact our government lies to us about very important things. And at this point, young people need to be trained by their parents and older relatives, because the school certainly won't mention it. But you need to teach young people, yeah, that government lies to you on a regular, ongoing basis. The media will lie to you because they're owned by corporations that pay for the media to promote their products and ideas. I mean, I was watching the news, the regular network TV news on one of the feeds coming into the studio here, and they were going on and on about what a wonderful opportunity it was to buy a Panasonic flat screen TV because prices have never been lower. And as we were reported last week, go ahead.
I usually get those during a hurricane. I go out and get one if I need one. You mentioned Cuba. Mentioned Cuba. 35 years ago today, the dearest and best President Kennedy was taken from us, all right?
45.
What many people, thank you. What many people don't realize, he too was in the process of changing things. At the very moment that he was shot, he had an emissary in Cuba talking to Fidel Castro too, and I quote, to get things moving again, as he was so wont to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We were going to talk about Kennedy a little bit later in the show here. And absolutely, do you know why Oswald was planted with the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, which is like the world's worst shoulder weapon, why that was the gun that was planted on him?
No idea.
Because that was the very model of gun that Castro was then importing into Cuba to give to all the Cuban citizens in advance of a potential second American invasion. And
Couldn't you find a better weapon in Texas that day?
Oh, Oswald certainly could have, but the whole point of the assassination of John F. Kennedy was originally intended to point the finger of blame at Cuba to justify that second invasion. That's why they had the phony Oswald going into the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. They tried to lay this trail to start a new war with Cuba, and LBJ had to head that off by giving them Vietnam. Thomas, stay with us. We got to take a break for some commercials. We'll be right back.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And we are on the phone right now with Thomas from Sweden. We started talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination. I was actually going to spend a lot more time on that during hour two of the show, but since we're in it, as we were talking before the break, the reason that Oswald was planted with the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, which is like the world's worst shoulder weapon, probably a big reason that Italy was losing when it was in World War II. Is that was the very rifle. It was a very, very inexpensive rifle, and Castro was importing them by the shipload to basically give to all the Cuban people so that they would be prepared if there was a repeat of the Bay of Pigs. Now, the people, the conspirators behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy, tried to set a trail of false evidence pointing the blame at Cuba in order to justify or anger the American people into a second invasion of Cuba, much as the World Trade Centers were brought down and the finger of blame pointed at the Muslims to try and create this climate in support of the conquest of the Middle East. Didn't quite work out. Lyndon Johnson had been in on the negotiations at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis and knew that if there were a new invasion of Cuba by the United States, that Russia would launch the missiles immediately without warning. That was the deal that had come down. So Lyndon Johnson bought off the military part of the military-industrial complex by saying, you guys can go play in Vietnam. We can't invade Cuba. I can't tell you why, but I'll let you go play in Vietnam. Go kill a bunch of people over there, and we'll tax the American people, and you'll make lots of money. And once the military support vanished from the conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy, then basically LBJ was able to say, okay, crazed, lone nut assassin, Lee Oswald, all by himself, no links to Cuba, he takes the blame, and, you know, Jack Ruby killed him in the Dallas police basement, and that was basically the end of the whole thing. So that was the reason LBJ was involved in the cover-up. It wasn't that he was necessarily protecting the assassins, is that he knew that if he didn't derail the rest of the plan, which was an invasion of Cuba, that we were really going to be back at the edge of World War III again. So, you know, sometimes when you're in those jobs, you have to make it's a difficult choice to make. Anyway, please continue.
Well, not only did they choose probably the world's worst rifle, they chose the Marine Corps' world's worst hog shooter. I've seen Oswald's records from the rifle range, and it says UNK, UNK, which is Marine Corps jargon for unqualified. He never qualified even with the M1.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a target even like, at the most, about 500 yards away, standing still. It's a great big circle.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hog shooter.
Yeah, he was terrible. That's why they put him in intelligence.
the most you could get in those days was 250 points. He got under 190.
Yeah, that was pretty bad stuff. In hindsight, looking back from a much more sophisticated era where we the American people understand shooting and they understand the fact that the government does lie to them. I mean, that's unavoidable now. You can't take the position, oh, the government would never lie to us. Yeah, they do. We found that out in 2003. And, as patsies go, Oswald was kind of lame. And, again, LBJ was, I mean, Oswald was definitely part of the original plan, but he was supposed to be the first step in a chain that led back to Cuba. So when it all started getting reshaped and re-engineered to prevent World War III, everybody was improvising, and they got stuck with a lot of really bad claims at the very beginning. And we'll never really know the whole story behind it. For me, the issue stops with the fact that we were lied to by the government and by the corporate media. And I have some very good examples of just how they did that to us at my website. And interesting little story here. The assassination of John Kennedy, like the first steps on the moon, it's one of those iconic moments in your life where you remember where you were the moment you found out. And I guess even back then, I was 8 years old at the time, and I didn't realize it at that moment, but I'd actually had a brush with this whole situation because my grandfather, who was very active in Republican politics in New Hampshire, was drinking buddies with Dick Nixon. And Dick Nixon, after he had lost his election to Kennedy, used to come up to New Hampshire because Senator Stiles Bridges was going to run against Kennedy in the end of the first term. Bridges was going to be the sacrificial lamb. And Nixon was coming up to help Bridges plan and coordinate resources for his to be the GOP nominee in 64. And Senator Bridges lived right across the street from my grandfather, and my mother and I were staying with my grandfather at this time. So Dick Nixon would talk to Senator Bridges, then he'd come over to visit my grandfather, and they'd get out the turkey nip, and my grandmother and mother would go off to play bingo because they didn't even want to be in the house, because my grandfather and Dick Nixon would get into the turkey nip, and they'd spend the night bitching about them damn Kennedy boys, and it was just going on and on and on. So anyway, Kennedy gets killed, and I keep all the magazines and newspaper articles, and I stash them away, and I didn't really look at them until Jim Garrison came out with his trial of Clay Shaw. And then I went back and actually looked at all these magazines I'd saved from the day, and I began to see all these very obvious signs that something wasn't lining up with the official story. And I have a lot of that material now on my webpage. It's one of the earlier pages I put together when I started this website 15 years ago. But it's amazing. We can be so convinced that our government media would never lie to us that we won't check for ourselves and will have the evidence of fraud and lie and deception right in front of our eyes, and we won't see it because we're blinded by these beliefs we've been indoctrinated with. And frankly, that was the moment when I decided in my life, I will never let belief rule my actions and thoughts ever, ever again. And that was the moment at which I began to decide that beliefs are really a very bad thing for humans to have, because it will blind you. It will trick you. You know, governments and religion rule by beliefs, because they don't have to prove anything. They just say, believe us, trust us. And, you know, the bottom line is, every people who were ever double-crossed or abused or used had it done to them by somebody they trusted. And so it's for this reason that I think belief of any kind should be avoided in your daily life. You either know the facts or you don't, and act accordingly. And as I said, now, you know, in the aftermath of the Iraq War, we know the U.S. government lies to us about very important things. They lied to us about Saddam's nuclear bombs, and the corporate American media helped them do it. And that is a hard reality that all Americans need to be dealing with, and they need to keep that in mind all the time. Even as Barack Obama takes office and we finally get out of the Bush years, we need to look at everything Barack Obama says through that lens of, we know government will lie to us if they feel it's justified. And, you know,
well, my new slogan around here is, I mean, Barack Obama, in order to have gotten this far, must be part of the system that creates these people that they allow to act as president. So my new slogan here is, keep the change.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one. All right, keep the change.
Yeah. You said you were talking about New Hampshire, you said, and you said bingo, only in Holderness, we used to call it Bino. They didn't pronounce the G.
Yeah, they actually, there were some places up there where they call it Bino as well, and I thought it was because they were actually using old dried beans as the markers on the cards. We used to do that down at, you know, at the Grange Hall. I used to go with my Aunt Mary to the Grange Hall all the time and just sit and watch them play, and I just think, this is the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. And I think that was when I started sort of getting out of this small town farm kid mentality and started aiming for the big city, as they say. All right, well, listen.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. All right. Now, one thing, at this party last week, I met a girl with rifles. I'm in love.
Yes, well, you know, I tell everybody around here that the reason my wife and I have such a wonderful marriage is matching his and hers assault rifles. None of us dares offend the other. Just first mistake, bang. And it works great. We love each other. We get along just fine. Thomas, we got to let you go. We got to take a break here for commercials and news. We'll be back with hour two of our show following the news break. So until then, aloha, America.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened Radio Show.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show, Hour 2, and greetings to all of the affiliates who join us for this second hour. And a reminder that we talk about the really fun stuff in Hour Number 1. Okay, a lot of stuff been happening. I was looking at the email real quick during the break, and some of our listeners were sending in some interesting items. One sent in these videos that are up on YouTube, and I'll be posting them to whatreallyhappened.com after today's show, of people doing stunts. Now, we're used to seeing people doing stunts on skateboards and bicycles and cars and motorcycles and all this other kind of stuff. These are being done with construction equipment, Caterpillar, bulldozers, bobcat loaders, and things like this. And I'm looking at these and thinking, there are some people that just have way too much time on their hands. But on the other hand, I'm realizing that for the manufacturers of these pieces of construction equipment, this is such a great opportunity for an ad campaign, you know, to show people out there, you know, hot dogging with this construction equipment. Of course, it's going to be a big headache for people who are out there trying to actually build construction sites and shopping centers and everything, because now all of their construction equipment operators are going to be trying to learn how to make it stand up on its rear wheels and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to look at. Now then, moving on down here, let's see. Here we are. Another listener letter. Yes, life is hard for General Motors right now. Not only are they building up in Brazil, but they also have a new plant in Russia that could use a billion or two of American taxpayer money. Don't you Americans just love globalization? You must. Obama just selected Gaethner from the New York Federal Reserve to run America's finances. Do the American people really think there is a blank thing in all of this for them? The corpse of America is the foundation for the New World Order. Bush is down in Peru right now promoting free trade like crazy. He's probably picking up some kickbacks in return for the assignment of more taxpayer money to the region. Don't you Americans feel like a bunch of screwed over saps yet? Yes, as a matter of fact, most of us do. Anyway, moving right along, we already talked about the economy last hour, and we were talking about Russia basically stepping into the void or vacuum that is being left as the United States continues to decline as not only a superpower, but even just a regional hemispheric power. We were talking about how Medvedev is visiting Venezuela and Cuba and establishing normal trade relations with them. And the war hawks in the United States are out there screaming it's a revival of the Cold War when Russia and Cuba held a knife to the throat of America. And I'm sorry, but the United States created this crisis. If Russia is finding a welcoming embrace from Cuba, it is only because the United States has kept an embargo on Cuba for the last half a century. What the United States should have done is, with the collapse of the USSR, is reopened normal relations with Cuba, sold them our cars, bought their sugar. That's the way of peace. We make products that you buy, you make products that we buy. Everybody has a nice life. We're all prosperous and peaceful. That's how it's supposed to work. But we've got a bunch of Cold War fossils in the U.S. government who know how to carry a grudge, and they're going to grind little tiny Cuba down into the ocean just to prove that they can do it. Plus, we've got the descendants of Batista's thugs still living in South Florida, and they're just bound to determine that it's really their Cuba that they're going to return to in triumph one day. The will of the Cuban people be darned. So now we are finding out that Russian President Medvedev is going to meet with President Bush in Peru this weekend to talk about who's really going to be down there establishing trade relations. And ahead of that meeting, we're hearing more and more warnings from Russia about the dangerous escalation of the United States placing anti-ballistic missile systems in Europe, which to me is a very blatant attempt by the United States to revive the Cold War, all the better to soak the American people for tax money for bombs and missiles in Russia and missile submarines with which to scare Russia. And before we pour trillions and trillions of dollars more into the military-industrial complex, we need to go back and re-listen to Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he said, "You're being suckered." The military-industrial complex is a power unto itself, and it will bleed ordinary working Americans dry to enrich themselves, all under the guise of protecting us against this enemy or that enemy out there. And if you want to know what you're going to be getting for your money, if you go along with this scam, then you go out to all those old missile silos all across the American Midwest, and you take a look down in them, because they are nothing but rusted, corroded holes in the ground now. All that money was spent for these missile systems and kept ready at huge expense. Thankfully, we never used them. The point being, we shouldn't have spent the money on them in the first place. And based on the last anti-ballistic missile test we had out here in Hawaii just this last week, it's not like we can hit anything anyway. So we could spend a huge amount of money to put these ABM missiles out there, escalate the nuclear tensions between Russia and the United States, thereby justifying more spending and more missiles. And the bottom line is that our ABM can't really hit anything anyway. Plus, when you add into that the fact that the Russians have now deployed a new maneuverable reentry vehicle, which is much more difficult to hit. And we have the American defense contractor saying, well, our anti-missile system can hit 75% of the targets that are coming in. And it sounds great, or even 90% they could make that claim. They were saying that about the Scud missile in Iraq. It didn't actually perform that well. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. It's 90% effective. So if Russia or some other enemy lobs 10 nuclear warheads at New York City, we're still going to lose New York. An ABM system that is anything less than 100% effective is a waste of money. It's just a jobs program for military people who don't want to go out and actually learn how to make products that other people might actually want to buy. It dead ends trillions and trillions of dollars. We pour that money down into the hole. There is a movie you should see, and it's called The Pentagon Wars. It was directed by Richard Benjamin. It's based on a book of the same name that was written by an insider talking about all the graft and corruption and incompetence that surrounded the development of the Bradley Infantry Fighting Vehicle. And it makes a wonderful movie. And it opens with this little speech by a general in the Pentagon, procurement division, played by Kelsey Grammer. And he's got this wonderful thing. We won the Cold War because we proved we could shovel the money into the fire faster than those Russians could. And that really is the mentality. You know, back in my days with NASA, I had a chance to interface with the military mindset. The amounts of money they spend, it is amazing. For ordinary Americans who are struggling to keep their homes and just their ordinary lives, the money running through our lives is like a tap in the kitchen, or a little bit of water coming out there. The people with military contracts, it's like they've got fire hoses pointing in every direction. That's the money, the flow of money. It's a whole different world, the sheer volume of monetary power they've got to play with. And it's obscene, because we can't get that kind of cash flow in our schools and hospitals, or fixing our roads or our flood control. It's all going to this vast war machine, and they're trying to sell you a new Cold War right now. And it's a scam, people. They're trying to scam you the way they scammed your grandparents. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We're not going to go down that road again. So we're coming to the end of the first segment, so I'm going to hold off the next bit of story here. And if you'd like to join us on the air, the number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. And, you know, obviously, I know you're out there listening, because I can see the little numbers on the little servers saying that you're out there, you know, hanging on to, well, maybe not hanging on every word, but you're out there listening, so you might want to grab that phone. So we're going to take a break here. We're going to have a couple of commercials, and then we're going to come back, and we are going to be, for pretty much the rest of the show, commemorating a very, very sad anniversary in American history. Today is, of course, the 45th anniversary of the John F. Kennedy assassination. We're going to be talking about that and the chain of events from that assassination to the current day. We'll be right back.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've got a caller waiting on the line. We're going to get to him in just a minute, but I have a couple of opening comments here. Probably everybody remembers where they were during certain events that sort of focus your attention at that particular moment in history. Obviously, when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon is one of them. And for those Americans who are my age, approximately, we all remember where we were when we got the word that John F. Kennedy had been killed in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas. And I remember I was at my school in Loudoun, New Hampshire, and they came out and they basically made an announcement and they let us all go home early. And I remember walking home and wondering how I was going to tell my mother, who I understood was a real big supporter of Kennedy, despite our obvious family ties to the Republicans. And of course, she'd already heard it and so forth and so on. So for the longest time, we all believed the official story, crazed lone nut Oswald just did it. Nothing you can do about that. And then over the years, of course, more and more information surfaced until finally we've reached a point where the majority of Americans are now very much of the opinion that there was a conspiracy that involved far more than just Lee Harvey Oswald. We've got callers piling up already, so we're going to go to John in Ohio. Aloha, John. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hello, Michael. I tuned in when you started talking about Cuba this hour, and I think this is sort of a microcosm of the sinister nature of the military-industrial CIA media complex in this country, that most people have been totally misled about the real nature of U.S. policy towards Cuba as just one outrageous example. There are people now in Miami walking around freely as heroes, who have been trained and armed and instigated by the CIA to wage a terrorist war against Cuba. They did such things as bombing Cuban hotels to try to destroy their tourist industry. Most notably, the most dastardly act was of these two individuals, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carrillo, CIA-trained agents going back to the Bay of Pigs, when they blew up a Cuban civilian airliner, killing all 76 civilians aboard in 1976. These people now are being harbored by this very same government that pretends to be waging a war against terrorism and using as an excuse that if they claim there's any terrorist as defined by the United States in any country, that country itself is a terrorist country, and that the United States has the right to bomb and slaughter people in any of those countries. And it's incredible that the media in this country, that's why I call it the CIA military-industrial media complex, has completely blacked out any mention of the fact that these people are now walking free after having been convicted of these kinds of terrorist crimes in a Panama court and being freed by the puppet Panamanian government just a few years ago. Yet some Cubans who are trying to stop some of this terrorism, CIA-instigated terrorism from this Cuban mafia in Miami, infiltrated these groups, did nothing harmful to the United States, simply to prevent a continuation of this terrorism. They went to the FBI naively thinking that maybe they might be interested in stopping it themselves, because some of these terrorists have actually bombed targets in the United States, Cuban embassies, and the rest of it. So they went, and the FBI, instead of arresting the terrorists, arrested them. They are now spending 15 years to life in prison. The media has completely blacked this out because they were fighting against terrorism. And if you this 50 years of terrorism that the United States has waged, from the Bay of Pigs invasion to germ warfare, to bombing hotels, to speedboat machine gunning of resorts, has completely gone under the radar of the American consciousness. And if you look at the Operation Northwoods plan back in the which started actually in the Nixon Eisenhower administration, and was carried over into the Kennedy administration to bomb American sites. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had plans to bomb American cities, kill American citizens, even blow up an American ship in Guantanamo, blame all of this on Cuba, frame them up, and use it as a pretext to invade Cuba. Thankfully, the Kennedy administration called that off. And I think now that we're in this situation, we realize one of the big motives for killing Kennedy was that he was moving towards getting out of Vietnam, normalizing relations with Cuba, and he said he was going to destroy the CIA and cast it to the wind because it was a threat to his back, because they were plotting these kinds of incredible false flag operations that were could lead us into a World War III. And so
Kennedy was angry with the CIA because he felt they had lied to him flat out, leading up to the Bay of Pigs situation.
Yeah, they were hoping that he would be trapped when he realized that he'd been lied to, that the Cuban people were not going to rise up after this proxy invasion. In fact, they rose up against the invasion, and they thought that he would be forced to send in a full scale invasion or air cover, and he realized he had been trapped, but he wasn't going to be led into that, and so they hated him for that. And so I think the case is closed on Kennedy because E. Howard Hunt, the top organizer of the Bay of Pigs invasion, the top CIA officer, and the leader of the Watergate break-in, confessed on his deathbed just recently, and as filmed by his own son with the audio and video, where he said that he was in effect, supervising in Dallas the assassination by the CIA of Kennedy. And yet the media completely blacked this out, shows what prostitutes they are, because here you have the smoking gun, case closed, and the only outlet was Rolling Stone that ran that that interview of his confession. So I think we've got to realize we're in real great danger, and I appreciate what you said about trying to move back into that kind of a phony Cold War era, simply to enrich the trillions of dollars that are going into this rat hole of the murder machine, the military-industrial complex. And I really appreciate that because, unfortunately, I think it's bipartisan. It always has been. And I think there's going to be the same kind of policies under Obama. He's called for no cut in any of that. In fact, 100,000 more troops and he's been surrounding himself with all of these right-wing war hawks like Rahm Emanuel and others in his administration. So I just think this has got to be a grassroots thing. We've got to take the blinders off and finally, as we're being pushed into total poverty, take back some of this robbery by Wall Street and the military-industrial complex, or we're going to go into World War III and a depression worse than the 30s.
Well, I think they're planning on trying to start a new Cold War or a real war to sort of hide the symptoms of the depression, because they look at how FDR got us out of the depression with World War II. John, we have to let you go and take a break here for some commercials. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Fear and hate will rule them, said the demon to the throne. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll show. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've got another caller waiting on the line. We're going to go to him in a minute, but I feel I must respond to this email from a listener, and it says, are you drinking a beer for breakfast? I'm not judging. I just think it's great if you are. Or was that iced tea? Obviously, they're watching through the webcam here, and I'm sorry to disillusion you. It is iced tea. There's no foamy head on the top of it. I'm not quite into that Rush Limbaugh level of substance abuse to get through my show. And Yes, I'm afraid I'm an iced tea-aholic, and I have a leaf on my back. So moving right along, though, we've got another caller on the line who wants to talk about the assassination of John Kennedy, and that's Clarence from Oklahoma. Aloha, Clarence. Welcome back to the show. Do we not have Clarence on the line? Okay, I guess we don't. Now, looking at the Kennedy assassination, this all happened back before there was an internet or an alternative media. And it's taken a very long time for the very obvious signs of deception to become known to the public. We put a poll up on whatreallyhappened.com earlier today if they thought that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in assassinating John F. Kennedy. The response was basically overwhelmingly no, that people are aware there was a conspiracy. We got one vote saying that, yes, Lee Oswald acted alone. I presume that's from the CIA spook they have monitoring with the content of the website every day, which I guess, you know, times are hard and it's either that or he's got to go work at McDonald's. But it took a long time to reach that. I think it was almost 30 years before we reached a point where half of America was aware that there was something with the official story. Thanks to the internet and the alternative media, the lifespan of a government lie is considerably smaller. When White House Deputy Counsel Vincent Foster was found dead in Fort Marcy Park and the official story was it was a suicide, it was probably, I would say, about 3 years. Before half of America knew that there was something funny with that story. The situation with 9/11, the lifespan of that lie was mere weeks. The lie about Saddam's nuclear bombs, same thing. That one was coming apart hardly before the ink had dried on the newspaper. And I keep mentioning this over and over again, that the world is changing and evolving, and technology is improving the means for ordinary people to communicate with each other on a mass basis. There is no going back. I know there's a lot of talk about Australia's new draconian internet filtering system. I know that the Attorney General designate for Obama's administration is on record as saying that content of the internet should be under control in the wake of Columbine, where a lot of information that contradicted the official story was getting out to the public. But, you know, if you go back and you look at Gutenberg inventing movable type printing, and all of a sudden inexpensive books became available to the common people, including a Bible, and that was the beginning of the decline of the church as absolute ruling authority over Europe. When ordinary people could read the Bible for themselves and find that there were contradictions, that what their local pastor had been telling them wasn't, in fact, actually in the Bible. And there were efforts by the ruling bodies then to control printing, to license it, to say you can only print certain things that we tell you. But in the long run, it didn't last. And I think efforts to control the internet and alternative media are ultimately doomed to failure, because people are always going to want the truth. And they will go where they think they can find it. In a society where the TV and radio networks and the newspapers were the only source of information, people would accept what was in them and say, okay, this is what we're being told, and we'll act as if this is reality. But now there's an alternative. A lot of people wonder what brought down the Soviet Union. And they say, was it overspending for Star Wars? Was it the disaster of Chernobyl? It was a wide variety of causes that weakened the Soviet Union. But in the end, fax machines brought it down. Because ordinary Russians who knew the government was lying about certain things could write it up and fax it to another 10 fax machines. And the people in those fax machines would read the article, and then they would forward it on to another 10, who would read it and forward it on to another 10. It was a network of fax machines called the Samizdat. And by way of the Samizdat, the Russian people found out the reality of what their government had been doing in their name. And obviously, technology has moved beyond fax machine networks. We have the internet. We have alternative media like GCN. And the reason the U.S. government is doomed is that it is still dominated by people who are convinced that they can go back to playing the game by the rules that worked at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and the 1960s, and that if they just wave Russians at us hard enough, that we'll stop thinking, that we'll stop seeing the lies and deception, and we'll just shovel the money into the furnace as hard as we can to fuel the military-industrial complex. And more to the point, that we will sacrifice the lives and well-being of our children in pointless wars in the far-flung reaches of the globe. Currently, the Arctic seems to be the new playground for the military-industrial complex. So, anyway, getting back to the Kennedy assassination, there were a lot of people who did not like John Kennedy. He came into office promising a lot of change and actually carrying through with it. He wanted to relax relations with Cuba. He wanted to get us out of Vietnam. He wanted to abandon the race for the moon in favor of a mutual cooperation space program, such as we have today with the Russians, to go to the moon and go to Mars and build space stations. And he also signed an executive order issuing a new form of currency in the United States. And it was new only in terms of its name. Functionally, it was a return to the days of the silver certificate. When this country was founded, the dollar was a fixed measure of silver. That's the origin of the word dollar. It's a unit of weight of silver from the Thaler mines in Germany. And the Thaler mines would sell their silver in cast circular discs of exact equal weight. And because they were so exacting in the weight of these silver discs, the silver discs became a unit of exchange that was accepted all throughout Europe. And when nations began to coin their own money, they used the German Thaler as their pattern in terms of the weight of the coin in silver, because it was a unit everybody already knew and already accepted. And so the Spanish mill dollar was essentially a German Thaler with different markings on it. And when the United States started up, our dollar was a silver dollar that was equal in weight to the German Thaler and was accepted around the world because silver is silver no matter where you go. When you look at the silver coins from the ancient Roman Empire, they are still worth their original issuing value because the coin had its own worth. And then somewhere along the line, somebody got the bright idea that, everybody was used to using paper dollars, which were claim checks for the real silver dollars. If you go back and you look at the earliest money that we had in this country before 1913, and they were called silver certificates, and it was written right on the bill that at any time you could take the paper note, go to the bank, and get that face value in real, honest-to-goodness silver. That was the foundation of our monetary system. And on that monetary system of a fixed unit of worth, we built the strongest economy in the world. We're going to take a break here. Speaking of economy, we're going to make some money by selling some commercials. When we come back, we're going to talk about John F. Kennedy's executive order and the Federal Reserve and the reason why this was probably at least part of the reason that John Kennedy was assassinated. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We were talking about the 45th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Americans overwhelmingly accept the fact there was a conspiracy among numerous parties to assassinate the president, and he had, in fact, angered a great many people. He had, in the wake of the Bay of Pigs invasion, felt the CIA had lied to him. He fired Alan Dulles. and basically threatened to break the CIA into 1,000 fragments and scatter them to the wind. He transferred control of covert military operations directly to the Pentagon, which had been formerly a CIA prerogative. He had canceled the oil depletion allowance, which allowed the Texas oil billionaires to become even bigger billionaires. Kennedy had done a lot of things that were very popular with the ordinary working people. And one of the ones that was really the biggest threat to the established order was his signing of an executive order authorizing the Treasury Department to begin to issue money again. Now, originally, that had been the Treasury's job. But then in 1913, during the Christmas break, a group of congressmen walked into the Capitol building, voice voted to waive the quota, the quorum requirement, so that they didn't have to have a minimum number of congressional representatives there, voted through the Federal Reserve Act, and then gaveled the session to a close. And by the time the rest of Congress came back from the holiday recess, it was a done deal. The bill was signed by the president and had become law. And with it, monetary policy was transferred from the U.S. government to a privately owned bank. You heard earlier a commercial, Ted Anderson's talking about the creature from Jekyll Island. This is how it all came to be. It was a national chartered bank with the legal authority to print up paper notes that were not backed by anything at all. Fiat currency, a unit of debt rather than a unit of worth. So John F. Kennedy recognized that the Federal Reserve was a big reason the United States was getting in deeper and deeper to debt and was losing its economic lead in the world. And so he signed an executive order for the Treasury to start issuing U.S. notes that were parallel with the Federal Reserve notes. And the U.S. notes were based on the silver that remained in the U.S. Treasury. And, of course, they were accepted as legal tender. And as soon as John Kennedy was assassinated, the U.S. notes were withdrawn from circulation and destroyed. You can still find them in collector's stores and various places like that. I have a few myself in my antique money collection. And then the year after John Kennedy was killed, of course, the silver was taken out of our coinage, and we got these copper-cladded slugs that we've been using ever since. We're going to go to the phones. We have Heath in Oklahoma. Aloha, Heath. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to I'm sorry I'm not terribly well researched on what I'm about to say because you've caught me in the car when you're talking about the JFK assassination, but I wanted to just mention something that you haven't touched on, I don't think, as yet, which was President Kennedy's vehement opposition to the Israelis developing a covert nuclear arsenal via the Dimona reactor in the Negev Desert, and
yes.
How you know, it was within months of him threatening to impose international cooperation on their plans that that he was killed. And I think that they need to be factored into the whole conspiracy.
Well, there were certain Israel was certainly one of the many groups that wanted John Kennedy out of power. It is very clear if you study the numerous scholarly works on to in Oliver Stone's movie, that there were numerous parties from numerous sources. You had CIA, mafia. You certainly had control of the media that came from certain sources. There were a lot of overlapping agendas that wanted to get rid of Kennedy, and they all basically got together and said, "We got to get rid of this guy because otherwise, all of our own personal agendas are going to take a hit." And yes, there is no question that Israel definitely did not like John F. Kennedy because he opposed them becoming a nuclear power.
I wanted to ask you something about that. I'm a little bit, just as I was I was desperately let down by Obama the day after he nudged Hillary Clinton out when he went in front of the AIPAC, whatever you call it, lobby group, and promised $30 billion in unconditional aid to Israel. I've also got the same sense of suspicion of Oliver Stone because for two reasons. One is that after doing some research on his film about JFK, he never mentioned the Israelis and their covert development of a nuclear capability. It was only then that I found that through some of the producers and executive producers of the film, There's a case for uncovering that he may have been financed deliberately to remove certain facets of the story, which I find a little suspicious. And having just seen the W film, I think one should ask whether or not Oliver Stone actually is a friend of is a friend of those that would, you know, be anti New World Order and anti corporate government, because the W film was, if ever I was going to try and do a damage limitation exercise on my family, I would ask for a film to be made in like the W film was made. It really missed out on a lot of what we know to be true.
Well, with the case of JFK, you know, Oliver Stone was riding high on his success for movies like Platoon, and he wanted to go out there and challenge the establishment, and he ran into a lot of opposition from that. If you look at the beginning of the movie, he cites the two books that he used as the source for the movie. One was On the Trail of the Assassins, I'm blanking on the name, but basically it was Jim Garrison's book and Jim Marr's book. Neither of those really goes into the Israel angle very much. You have to get into Michael Collins Piper before that information begins to surface. So at this point, I'm willing to say that Stone may just not have been aware of it during that phase of the movie. And but JFK and Nixon, slightly lesser extent, were very well done movies. But all of his later movies, it does seem like the leash has been put on him. And he's not going to cross certain lines. There is no question that the U.S. government wields a tremendous amount of covert influence in Hollywood. That goes all the way back to the end of World War II. There's a page on my website that I'll link once the show is over, so you can go back and visit the history of the FBI in Hollywood. And it's also true that Israel, through the CIAN network, also wields a tremendous amount of influence inside Hollywood. To make sure that certain things are not mentioned in American movies and TVs. I mean, if you think about it, in movies coming out of the United States, drug dealers and drug criminals are always South American or Negro. And yet, certainly, you know, these two individuals have very little to do with the ecstasy trade, which almost gets no press at all in American TV and film. So, yeah, there's definitely a bias, and everybody's pushing their own agendas, and some of them have a tremendous amount of influence. As far as Obama going before AIPAC, we are still dealing with the reality that nobody can get elected to office in the United States unless Israel says it's okay. And
well, I
until
think that
we
that's,
get...
the problem that I have with that is that I understand where that comes from, and if you're in the tight political environment of Washington, they may be able to by surrounding you with people that tell you it's not possible. That might be the case, but I think that this is like the Hans Christian Andersen story of the emperor in his new clothes, because I can tell you something. I read the media, and I deferred a PhD, which I just wanted to mention in a moment, but I read the news very carefully for signs of what's going on and what message they're imparting to us. And I can tell you that I signed up as a to receive newsletters from the Obama campaign, because I was enamored by him originally. And and then once he picked out Hillary Clinton and he went before AIPAC, I know that there was the first thing I did was email his campaign and told him that I was disgusted with him, and I know that I was part of a groundswell of what must have been tens of thousands, because the very next day Wolf Blitzer on CNN on his despicable program Situation Room spent half an hour on a piece dedicated to why the lobby groups are our friends. So that told me that there was an internet based campaign or reaction, negative reaction to what he had done. So I think that you're right that the people are led to believe that they can't be elected, but I don't think that that is actually the reality. That if he'd have had some guts, and if he really is a person that wants to change, and he has not been pre-selected to be a president.
Okay, Heath, I've got to get in here for a couple of minutes. You're absolutely correct. I'm of the opinion that Israel's influence is on the wane. It's still there and it has to be dealt with, but I think we're rapidly reaching the point where support for Israel is going to be seen as a negative rather than a positive in future campaigns. I certainly hope that will be the case when we get to the elections of 2010. That's it for our Saturday show. I have to go do my other day job here situation. So until Monday, stay safe, be well, hug your loved ones, drive carefully, especially if you're under terrible weather like us, and aloha, America. We'll